So the question becomes why? Why is it that people have so much trouble hearing this information? From my work, I think we would be remiss not to look at the impact of trauma. My name is Marty Hopper, and I'm a PhD clinical psychologist. I've been working and living for the past 30 years here in Boulder, Colorado. For the past 11 years, my work has focused on helping people who have experienced personal trauma. Now, as we know, the horrors of what happened on 9/11 were televised all over the world, and they were televised, in fact, live. We witnessed the deaths of almost 3,000 of our fellow Americans. We know this had a very severe and traumatic impact on a majority of the population. I myself cried for weeks after September 11th. A friend of mine who is a psychologist in practice here in Boulder said that her caseload increased tremendously after 9/11, and people that she hadn't seen in 10 years were coming back into her practice. So I think it's safe to say that collectively as a nation, because of what happened on September 11th, we experienced trauma.
I'm Fran Schur, and I have a master's degree from the University of Colorado. I've had a private practice as a psychotherapist and as a licensed professional counselor for about 20 years. Why do people resist this information, the information that shows that the official story about 9/11 cannot be true? What I've learned is that as humans, each of us have a worldview, and that worldview is usually formed in great part by the culture we grow up in. When we hear information that contradicts our worldview, social psychologists call the resulting insecurity cognitive dissonance. For example, with 9/11, we have one cognition, which is what the official story of 9/11, what our government told us, what our media repeated to us over and over, that 19 Muslims attacked us. On the other hand, we have what scientists, researchers, architects, engineers are now beginning to tell us, which is that there is evidence that shows that the official story cannot be true. So now we've lost our sense of security. We are starting to feel vulnerable. Now we're confused.
9/11 truth challenges some of our most fundamental beliefs about our government and about our country. When your beliefs are challenged or when two beliefs are inconsistent, cognitive dissonance is created. 9/11 truth challenges the beliefs that our country protects us and keeps us safe and that America is the good guy. My name is Bob Hopper, and I have a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Cincinnati. For the past 29 years, I've been a licensed PhD clinical psychologist in Boulder, Colorado. When your beliefs are challenged, fear and anxiety are created. In response to that, our psychological defenses kick in, and they protect us from these emotions. Denial, which is probably the most primitive psychological defense, is the one most likely to kick in when our beliefs are challenged.
I'm Danielle Dupre, PhD, originally from Switzerland, where I studied psychology and psychoanalysis. For the past 15 years, I've been empowering people who have experienced significant trauma. America is a powerful nation. It has never been attacked. We were confident, we felt secure, and all of a sudden that security collapsed. People started to be fearful. With all those rumors, those news, people didn't know what to think about. And it's a very, very uncomfortable state to be in. And eventually, our mind shuts off. Just like when a computer is overloaded, our minds get overloaded. We can't handle it anymore, and we shut down. It's easier to deny it and move on with our lives.
What some of us will tend to do is deny the evidence that's coming our way and stick to the original story, the official story, and to try to regain our equilibrium in that way. Another thing we can do is decide to look at the conflicting evidence and be sincere and be open-minded and look at both sides of the issue and then make up our own mind about what reality is.
I'm Dorothy Lorig. I have a master's degree in counseling psychology from the University of Colorado, and I've been practicing reevaluation counseling for over 16 years. If we can think of our worldview as being sort of our mental and emotional home, I think all of us will do just about anything to defend our homes, to defend our families. And so I see that with people, and I saw that with myself when my brother tried to talk with me about it, of don't mess with me, don't mess with my home, don't mess with my comfort with how things are. And about a week later, I read a lengthy article by Professor Griffin about why he believes the official account of 9/11 cannot be true. And it was a very well-researched article. I was in my office at the time. I sat there and I felt my stomach churning. I thought maybe I was going to be sick. And I leaped out of my chair and ran out the door and took a long walk around the block, around several blocks, and just broke down. I understand now that what was happening was my worldview about my government being in some way my protector, almost like a parent, had been dashed, and it was like being cast out into the wilderness, I think is the closest way to describe that feeling. And I sobbed and I sobbed, felt like the ground had completely disappeared beneath my feet, and I knew at some point during the walk that I knew that I was going to have to become active in educating other people about this, that there was that for me to retain any sense of integrity, I was going to have to take some action. I couldn't just let something like this go.
Many people respond to these truths in a very deep way. Some have a visceral reaction like they've been punched in the stomach. To begin to accept the possibility that the government was involved is like opening Pandora's box. If you open the lid and peek in a little bit, It's going to challenge some of your fundamental beliefs about the world.
Well, here are a few of those spontaneous initial reactions to hearing the contradictory evidence about 9/11.
I don't want to know the truth, or I'd become too negative and psychologically go downhill. I'm not sure I want to know. If this is true, then up would be down and down would be up. My life would never be the same.
Fran, I refuse to believe that many Americans could be that treasonous. Someone would have talked. But these are beliefs. They are not scientific facts. But these beliefs do keep us from looking at the empirical evidence.
I'm David Ray Griffin. I taught philosophy of religion and theology at the Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. I published about 35 books in my field, but then starting in 2004, I started publishing about 9/11, and since that time, I have published 10 books about 9/11. You have empirical people who will simply say, look at the evidence, and if it's convincing, I will change my mind. Other people are paradigmatic people. They have a paradigm. They say, this is the way the world works, and I'm convinced this is the right way the world works. 9/11 doesn't fit into that paradigm, so I don't need to look at the evidence. It's paradigmatic. And then there is a third type of person that we often call wishful thinkers. I call it wishful and fearful thinking. So they simply will not believe something that they fear to be the truth. And I found that maybe to be the most powerful factor of people rejecting 9/11 truth and not even entertaining the evidence.
So whenever we say, I refuse to believe, we can be sure that the evidence that's coming our way is not bearable and that it's conflicting with our worldview much too much.
Denial protects people from this kind of anxiety.
As I thought about all of these responses, I realized that what is common to every one of them is the emotion of fear. People are afraid of being ostracized, they're afraid of being alienated, they're afraid of being shunned, They're afraid of their lives being inconvenienced. They'd have to change their lives. They're afraid of being confused. They're afraid of psychological deterioration. They're afraid of feeling helpless and vulnerable. And they're afraid that they won't be able to handle the feelings that are coming up. None of us want to feel helpless and vulnerable. So we want to defend ourselves. And the way we often do that is with anger. So then we become angry. And when we become angry, then we become indignant. We become offended. We want to ridicule the messenger. We want to pathologize the messenger. And we want to censor the messenger.
So how can we overcome this resistance and denial? The first thing is to meet people where they're at.
One thing is that we need to raise people's awareness about this through what I would call gentle dialogue and gentle questioning. My name is John Freedom. I'm a counselor in private practice here in Tucson, Arizona, which I've been for the past 20 years. I hold a master's level certification in NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming. So it doesn't work to challenge people's belief or immediately tell them, you know, I know the truth about 9/11, but a good way is to ask questions, ask open-ended questions, and lead them into a dialogue and discussion about it.
Healing comes through facing the truth, experiencing it, allowing the feelings to come in, so that if there are feelings of fear that perhaps these events were caused by something that we haven't thought about yet, dark elements within our society, for example, we'll let that come in and explore it. Let the light shine on whatever happened. This will be the most healing process. The Germans did this after their war. The South Africans did this after apartheid. Reconciliation through the truth is what is a deep path to psychological recovery from the myths and lies around which this historical event has been cloaked in the official view. I am Professor William Woodward. I'm trained in the history of science with a PhD. I also have a master's in experimental psychology. I've edited 4 books and published well over 20 peer-reviewed papers. I've taught for 35 years at a state university, the University of New Hampshire. I think as a psychologist, to overcome our fear of the traumatic event with new information would be the best, healthiest route to our collective recovery from the trauma of 9/11. That, by the way, is a psychotherapeutic insight that to gradually uncover the truth in your own life, the sources of anxiety, to make them conscious, is the royal road to recovery.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is September 11th, 2012, or surprised to learn this when I looked at my Google Calendar, Patriots Day, as it is now called. So we all know what patriotism is about. And today, we're going to be talking about a near opposite of patriotism, critical thinking. Anyway, what you've heard so far is some clips that I selected from a documentary that was released earlier this year called 9/11 Explosive Evidence Experts Speak Out. This film, which is about 2 hours and 15 minutes, is a compendium of testimony from a variety of experts, physicists, engineers, psychologists, with, I don't want to say fresh, because it's obviously a lot of material that we've gone over before, on the topic of 9/11. Most of it I could take or leave. I watched the documentary because this was a subject at one time that I was very interested in, and I was intrigued. I wanted to see if there was any new development in the science. But as I've talked about several times on the show, this is certainly at this point not a preoccupation of mine. But I remember this part around the two-hour mark really standing out for me. And obviously, this is familiar ground for this show. But I thought, you know, given the events of today, 11 years ago, and the subsequent reaction from the public and the policies from the government and the almost blind acceptance of those policies, that this would be a fitting day for this show. Anyway, what we're going to be doing today is reading an article. I just want to warn you, this show is me reading an article. Now, why do I say I want to warn you? Well, some people tune in for production. And I remember I've done this on the show in the past, and somebody emailed me and said, Brad, you shouldn't just sit there and read an article on your show. No one wants to tune in for that. To which I responded, I'll do whatever I want on my show. And that's what we're doing today. And frankly, you know, I would much rather have somebody read an article to me than, you know, me sit there in front of the computer and read it myself. This way you can also bring it with you. You can get involved in something else while you are taking in the article. You can knit, you can straighten up that room of yours, you can go for a ride in the car. So I consider this a service. And you know what? I really don't think I have to sell this. This is what's happening. That's what today's show is. I'm going to read you this article because I think this is something very important that I would like to put into the record. I recently discovered this website called the Critical Thinking Community. It is at criticalthinking.org. Now, I originally wanted to share a journal article with you that I found on this site called Critical Thinking and Emotional Intelligence, something that we've been speaking about quite a bit on the show in recent episodes. But doing a search of the author, learning a little bit more about the author of this piece, I eventually stumbled across something that I thought was more applicable and useful to us, even though it is a theory. But I thought this provided a very interesting working structure to talk about the development of critical thinking skills. Now, I could not read both of these articles in one show. I will link them both in the show notes. But to deal with the important issue of emotional intelligence, we are going to go to YouTube for that. And you will hear more about that after we deal with this article. So it's called Critical Thinking Development, A Stage Theory by Linda Elder and Richard Paul. Linda Elder was the author that I had followed from the original article that I wanted to share, Critical Thinking and Emotional Intelligence. And here's what I found. She has a little bio here on the Critical Thinking Community website. It says, Dr. Linda Elder is an educational psychologist and a prominent authority on critical thinking. She is president of the Foundation for Critical Thinking and executive director of the Center for Critical Thinking. Dr. Elder has taught psychology and critical thinking at the college level and has given presentations to more than 20,000 educators at all levels. She has co-authored 4 books, including Critical Thinking, Tools for Taking Charge of Your Learning and Your Life, Critical Thinking, Tools for Taking Charge of Your Professional and Personal Life, and 25 Days to Better Thinking and Better Living. She has co-authored 18 thinker's guides on critical thinking and co-authors a quarterly column on critical thinking in the Journal of Developmental Education. Dr. Elder has also developed an original stage theory of critical thinking development. Concerned with understanding and illuminating the relationship between thinking and effect, and the barriers to critical thinking, Dr. Elder has placed these issues at the center of her thinking and her work. With experience in both administration and the classroom, Dr. Elder understands firsthand the problems facing educators. She is a dynamic presenter who reaches her audience on a person-to-person level. I'm going to tell you that my belief system, I can tell just from what I read, and Dr. Elder's beliefs are not in perfect harmony, and I don't even want to use the word belief for my system. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in the show today. But the first thing that I thought would be worth examining before we even get into the article that I wanted to read was Critical Thinking Development, Stage Theory. This is written by Dr. Elder, along with somebody named Richard Paul. And well, I guess the best way is to start from the beginning. This is going to take a little while to read, but there are 6 stages, according to Dr. Elder's theory of critical thinking. Now, this is just a model that I think might be useful. It's a way that I had never thought about it before. We talk about it in a similar way, but this is really giving some structure to this problem that we face that today, I think, many of us are reminded of even more than the other 364 days of the year. So we will start from the beginning of critical thinking development, a stage theory. And like I said, because there are certain philosophical differences between myself and the author, which will become very apparent, if I am compelled to pause and discuss, I will do that. Try not to derail the article, but there might be some places where I think some commentary is necessary. So here we go. Though most educators aspire to make critical thinking a primary objective of their instruction, most also do not realize that to develop as thinkers, students must pass through stages of development in critical thinking. That is, most teachers are unaware of the levels of intellectual development that people go through as they improve as thinkers. We believe that significant gains in the intellectual quality of student work will not be achieved except to the degree that teachers recognize that skilled critical thinking develops only when properly cultivated, and only through predictable stages. I don't agree that this is something that needs to be cultivated by authorities, but I still think that the model is useful. Continuing on. In this paper, we shall set out a stage theory based on nearly 20 years of research of the Center for Critical Thinking and explain some of the theory's implications for instructions. We shall be brief, concise, and to the point in our explanation with minimal theoretical elaboration. Furthermore, we believe that the practicality of the theory we explain here is best tested in the classroom and in everyday life. The reader should be expressly aware that we are approaching the human mind exclusively from an intellectual standpoint, not from a psychological standpoint. Each stage of intellectual development will be explained in terms of the following variables. Number one, defining feature. Number two, principal challenge. Number three, knowledge of thinking. Number four, skill in thinking. Number five, relevant intellectual traits. Number six, some implications for instruction. Due to space limitations, we have made no attempt to be exhaustive with respect to any stage, nor answer the many questions that might be raised concerning the development, reliability, or validity of the stages. The basic intention is to provide a practical organizer for teachers interested in using a conceptual map to guide student thinking through developmental stages in the process of becoming critical thinkers. I would add to that self-teachers, not just teachers in front of a classroom. And, a lot of people are trying to do some instruction or at least encourage curiosity in others through their discussions. So I think this might be helpful there as well. Maybe identifying which stage somebody who you're having a discussion with is at, where you are at, and perhaps how to move forward, even if you don't fully accept the model that Elder lays out here. Continuing on, once the stages are explained and stage-specific recommendations are given, we close with some global implications for instruction. We make the following assumptions. Number one, that there are predictable stages through which every person who develops as a critical thinker passes. Two, that passage from one stage to the next is dependent upon a necessary level of commitment on the part of an individual to develop as a critical thinker and is not automatic and is unlikely to take place subconsciously. Three, that success in instruction is deeply connected to the intellectual quality of student learning. And four, that regression is possible in development. Before moving to the stages themselves, a brief overview of what we mean by critical thinking is in order. Our working definition is as follows. We define critical thinking as the ability and disposition to improve one's thinking by systematically subjecting it to intellectual self-assessment. It is important to recognize that on this view, persons are critical thinkers in the fullest sense of the term only if they display this ability and disposition in all or most of the dimensions of their lives. As a parent, citizen, consumer, lover, friend, learner, and professional. We exclude from our concept of the critical thinker those who think critically in only one dimension of their lives. We do so because the quality of one's life is dependent upon high-quality reasoning in all domains of one's life, not simply in one dimension. The stages we will lay out are as follows. Stage 1, the unreflective thinker. Stage 2, the challenged thinker. Stage 3, the beginning thinker. Stage 4, the practicing thinker. Stage 5, the advanced thinker. And stage 6, the accomplished thinker. So here we go with stage one, the unreflective thinker. Defining feature. Unreflective thinkers are largely unaware of the determining role that thinking plays in their lives and of the many ways that problems in thinking are causing problems in their lives. Unreflective thinkers lack the ability to explicitly assess their thinking and improve it thereby. Knowledge of thinking. Unreflective thinkers lack the knowledge that high-quality thinking requires. Regular practice in taking thinking apart, accurately assessing it, and actively improving it. In fact, unreflective thinkers are largely unaware of thinking as such, hence fail to recognize thinking as involving concepts, assumptions, inferences, implications, points of view, etc. Unreflective thinkers are largely unaware of the appropriate standards for the assessment of thinking: clarity, accuracy, precision, relevance, logicalness, etc. Skill in thinking. Unreflective thinkers may have developed a variety of skills in thinking without being aware of them. However, these skills are inconsistently applied because of the lack of self-monitoring of thought. Prejudices and misconceptions often undermine the quality of thought of the unreflective thinker. Some implications for instruction, and to every one of these, I'm just going to add self-instruction. We must recognize that in the present mode of instruction, it is perfectly possible for students to graduate from high school or even college and still be largely unreflective thinkers. You're kidding. Though all students think, most students are largely unaware of how their thinking is structured or how to assess or improve it. Thus, when they experience problems in thinking, they lack the skills to identify and fix these problems. Most teachers do not seem to be aware of how unaware most students are of their thinking. Little is being done at present to help students discover their thinking. This emphasis needs shifting. Stage two, the challenged thinker. Defining features. Thinkers move to the challenge stage when they become initially aware of the determining role that thinking is playing in their lives, and of the fact that problems in their thinking are causing them serious and significant problems. The principal challenge: to become initially aware of the determining role of thinking in one's life and of basic problems that come from poor thinking. Knowledge of thinking. Challenge thinkers, unlike unreflective thinkers, are becoming aware of thinking as such. They are becoming aware at some level that high-quality thinking requires deliberative, reflective thinking about thinking, metacognition, in order to improve thinking. They recognize that their thinking is often flawed, although they are not able to identify many of these flaws. Challenge thinkers may develop an initial awareness of thinking as involving concepts, assumptions, inferences, implications, points of view, etc., and as involving the standards for the assessment of thinking: clarity, accuracy, precision, relevance, logicalness, etc., though they have only an initial grasp of these standards and what it would take to internalize them. Challenge thinkers also develop some understanding of the role of self-deception in thinking, though their understanding is limited. At this stage, the thinker develops some reflective awareness of how thinking operates for good or ill. Their skill in thinking. Most challenged thinkers have very limited skills in thinking. However, like unreflective thinkers, they may have developed a variety of skills in thinking without being aware of them, and these skills may ironically serve as barriers to development. At this stage, thinkers with some implicit critical thinking abilities may more easily deceive themselves into believing that their thinking is better than it actually is, making it more difficult to recognize the problems inherent in poor thinking. To accept the challenge at this level requires that thinkers gain insight into the fact that whatever intellectual skills they have are inconsistently applied across the domains of their lives. The fundamental intellectual trait at this stage is intellectual humility, in order to see that problems are inherent in one's thinking. Some implications for instruction or self-instruction. We must recognize the importance of challenging our students in a supportive way to recognize both that they are thinkers and that their thinking often goes awry. We must lead class discussions about thinking. We must explicitly model thinking, e.g. thinking aloud through a problem. We must design classroom activities that explicitly require students to think about their thinking. We must have students examine both poor and sound thinking, talking about the differences. We must introduce students to the parts of thinking and the intellectual standards necessary to assess thinking. We must introduce the idea of intellectual humility to students, that is, the idea of becoming aware of our own ignorance. Perhaps children can best understand the importance of this idea through their concept of the know-it-all, which comes closest to their recognition of the need to be intellectually humble. Now, let's pause there for a minute. I've interacted with a lot of people and discussed a variety of different subjects. And I would say that most of those people in my regular everyday life would probably fit into this category. I think it's interesting that she points out talking about thinking or metacognition, thinking about thinking. This is something that I always ask students to do when I'm working with them one-on-one for standardized test prep. And I think the ones that I work on most regularly do help build critical thinking skills. But the first thing that I want to see students do is talk through a problem and tell me out loud what they would do to solve it. I always find this interesting. I always find this instructive. I believe that I started doing this really out of my own curiosity, as over time I realized there were multiple approaches to many of the SAT math problems. I was always interested in seeing what students would come up with. But a lot of students are uncomfortable doing that at first because, as Dr. Elder points out in this article, they've never been asked to do it before. Let's move on to stage three, the beginning thinker. The defining feature. Those who move to the beginning thinker stage are actively taking up the challenge to begin to take explicit command of their thinking across multiple domains of their lives. Thinkers at this stage recognize that they have basic problems in their thinking and make initial attempts to better understand how they can take charge of and improve it. Based on this initial understanding, beginning thinkers begin to modify some of their thinking, but have limited insight into the deeper levels of the trouble inherent in their thinking. Most importantly, they lack a systematic plan for improving their thinking. Hence, their efforts are hit and miss. The principal challenge? To begin to see the importance of developing as a thinker. To begin to seek ways to develop as a thinker and to make an intellectual commitment to that end. Knowledge of thinking. Beginning thinkers, unlike challenge thinkers, are becoming aware not only of thinking as such, but also of the role in thinking of concepts, assumptions, inferences, implications, points of view, etc. Beginning thinkers are also at some beginning stage of recognizing not only that there are standards for the assessment of thinking, clarity, accuracy, precision, relevance, logicalness, etc., but also that one needs to internalize them and thus begin using them deliberately in thinking. They have a beginning understanding of the role of egocentric thinking in human life. The skill in thinking. Beginning thinkers are able to appreciate a critique of their powers of thought. Beginning thinkers have enough skill in thinking to begin to monitor their own thoughts, though as beginners, they are sporadic in that monitoring. They are beginning to recognize egocentric thinking in themselves and others. Relevant intellectual traits. The key intellectual trait required at this stage is some degree of intellectual humility in beginning to recognize the problems inherent in thinking. In addition, thinkers must have some degree of intellectual confidence in reason, a trait which provides the impetus to take up the challenge and begin the process of active development as critical thinkers, despite limited understanding of what it means to do high-quality reasoning. In addition, beginning thinkers have enough intellectual perseverance to struggle with serious problems in thinking while yet lacking a clear solution to those problems. In other words, at this stage, thinkers are recognizing more and more problems in their thinking, but have not yet discovered how to systematize their efforts to solve them. Some implications for instruction. Once we have persuaded most of our students that much of their thinking, left to itself, is flawed, and that they, like all of us, are capable of improving as thinkers. Now, whoa, let's pause right there. Left to itself, it is flawed. Kind of letting a certain institution off the hook there, as far as I'm concerned, Dr. Elder. Much of their thinking, if left to itself, is flawed. Is that what's going on in school? Thinking is being left to itself? All right, let's start that again. Remember, we're just looking at this for a model, you know, to maybe make some of this a little bit more concrete. And for that, I think it is helpful. Like I said, I don't agree with Dr. Elder on, you know, her educational philosophy. And I think it's safe to say that if you listen to and enjoy this show at this point, you might not either. Some aspects of it, anyway. Once we have persuaded most of our students that much of their thinking, left to itself, is flawed, and that they, like all of us, are capable of improving as thinkers, we must teach in such a way as to help them to see that we all need to regularly practice good thinking to become good thinkers. Here we can use sporting analogies and other analogies from skill areas. Most students already know that you can get good in a sport only if you regularly practice. We must not only look for opportunities to encourage them to think well, we must help them to begin to understand what it is to develop good habits of thinking. What do we need to do regularly in order to read well? What must we do regularly and habitually if we are to listen well? What must we do regularly and habitually if we are to write well? What must we do regularly and habitually if we are to learn well? We must recognize that students are not only creatures of habit, but like the rest of us, they are largely unaware of the habits they are developing. They are largely unaware of what it is to develop good habits in general, let alone good habits of thinking. If our students are truly beginning thinkers, they will be receptive to the importance of developing sound habits of thought. We must emphasize the importance of beginning to take charge of the parts of thinking and applying intellectual standards to thinking. We must teach students to begin to recognize their native egocentrism when it is operating in their thinking. We are going to talk more about this term egocentrism and what Elder means by that. I know that might be jabbing at a couple people. Stage 4, the practicing thinker, the defining feature. Thinkers at this stage have a sense of the habits they need to develop to take charge of their thinking. They not only recognize that problems exist in their thinking, but they also recognize the need to attack these problems globally and systematically. Based on their sense of the need to practice regularly, they are actively analyzing their thinking in a number of domains. However, since practicing thinkers are only beginning to approach the improvement of their thinking in a systematic way, they still have limited insight into the deeper levels of thought and thus into deeper levels of the problems embedded in thinking. The principal challenge? To begin to develop awareness of the need for systematic practice in thinking. Their knowledge of thinking at this stage. Practicing thinkers, unlike beginning thinkers, are becoming knowledgeable of what it would take to systematically monitor the role of their thinking of concepts, assumptions, inferences, implication, points of view, etc. Practicing thinkers are also becoming knowledgeable of what it would take to regularly assess their thinking for clarity, accuracy, precision, relevance, logicalness, etc. Practicing thinkers recognize the need for systematicity of critical thinking and deep internalization into habits. They clearly recognize the natural tendency of the human mind to engage in egocentric thinking and self-deception. Their skill in thinking. Practicing thinkers have enough skill in thinking to critique their own plan for systematic practice and to construct a realistic critique of their powers of thought. Furthermore, practicing thinkers have enough skill to begin to regularly monitor their own thoughts. Thus, they can effectively articulate the strengths and weaknesses in their thinking. Practicing thinkers can often recognize their own egocentric thinking as well as egocentric thinking on the part of others. Furthermore, practicing thinkers actively monitor their thinking to eliminate egocentric thinking, although they are often unsuccessful. Relevant intellectual traits at this stage. The key intellectual trait required to move to this stage is intellectual perseverance. This characteristic provides the impetus for developing a realistic plan for systematic practice with a view to taking a greater command of one's thinking. Furthermore, thinkers at this stage have the intellectual humility required to realize that thinking in all of the domains of their lives must be subject to scrutiny as they begin to approach the improvement of their thinking in a systematic way. Some implications for instructions. What are the basic features of thinking that students must command to effectively become practicing thinkers? What do they need to do to take charge of their thinking intellectually with respect to any content? We must teach in such a way that students come to understand the power in knowing that whenever humans reason, they have no choice but to use certain predictable structures of thought. The thinking is inevitably driven by questions, that we seek answers to questions for some purpose. That to answer questions, we need information, that to use information, we must interpret it, i.e. making inferences, and that our inferences, in turn, are based on assumptions and have implications, all of which involves ideas or concepts within some point of view. We must teach in such a way as to require students to regularly deal explicitly with these structures. Students should now be developing the habit, whenever they are trying to figure something out, of focusing on purpose, question, information, inferences, assumptions, concepts, point of view, and implications. The result of this emphasis in instruction is that students begin to see connections between all the subject matter they are learning. In studying history, they learn to focus on historical purposes and questions. When studying math, they clarify and analyze mathematical goals and problems. When studying literature, they reflect upon literary purposes and questions. They notice themselves making historical, mathematical, and literary assumptions. They notice themselves tracing historical, mathematical, and literary implications. Recognizing the moves one makes in thinking well is an essential part of becoming a practicing thinker. Students should be encouraged to routinely catch themselves thinking both egocentrically and sociocentrically. They should understand, for example, that most of the problems they experience in learning result from a natural desire to avoid confusion and frustration, and that their inability to understand another person's point of view is often caused by their tendency to see the world exclusively within their own egocentric point of view. That's the end of stage four. So let's talk a little bit more about what she means by egocentric here. From what I've read from Linda Elder, egocentric is used to describe a kind of emotional defense. And she also talks about this in the other article that I wanted to look at today, which is about critical thinking and emotional intelligence. And the egocentric point of view is what we had talked about in the show with Larkin Rose, and we talked about in the show with the political debate contract. I guess the best way to sum it up would be when people are not really having a conversation as an information exchange, but only with the goal of escaping that conversation with their previous belief system safely intact. Their comfortable worldview, unaltered by the introduction of new, uncomfortable facts. I think that's a good working definition. Stage five. The advanced thinker. The defining feature here, thinkers at this stage have now established good habits of thought which are paying off. Based on these habits, advanced thinkers not only actively analyze their thinking in all the significant domains of their lives, but also have significant insight into the problems at deeper levels of thought. While advanced thinkers are able to think well across the important dimensions of their lives, they are not yet able to think at a consistently high level across all of these dimensions. Advanced thinkers have a good general command over their egocentric nature. They continually strive to be fair-minded. Of course, they sometimes lapse into egocentrism and reason in a one-sided way. The principal challenge. To begin to develop a depth of understanding not only of the need for systematic practice in thinking, but also insight into deep levels of problems in thought. Consistent recognition, for example, of egocentric and sociocentric thought in one's thinking, the ability to identify areas of significant ignorance and prejudice, and the ability to actually develop new fundamental habits of thought based on deep values to which one has committed oneself. Their knowledge of thinking. Advanced thinkers are actively and successfully engaged in systematically monitoring the role in their thinking of concepts, assumptions, inferences, implications, points of view, etc., and hence have excellent knowledge of that enterprise. Advanced thinkers are also knowledgeable of what it takes to regularly assess their thinking for clarity, accuracy, precision, relevance, logicalness, etc. Advanced thinkers value the deep and systematic internalization of critical thinking into their daily habits. Advanced thinkers have keen insight into the role of egocentrism and sociocentrism in thinking, as well as the relationship between thoughts, feelings, and desires. They have a deep understanding of the powerful role that thinking plays in the quality of their lives. They understand that egocentric thinking will always play a role in their thinking, but that they can control the power that egocentrism has over their thinking and their lives. Skill in thinking. Advanced thinkers regularly critique their own plan for systematic practice and improve it thereby. Practicing thinkers regularly monitor their own thoughts. They insightfully articulate the strengths and weaknesses in their thinking. They possess outstanding knowledge of the qualities of their thinking. Advanced thinkers are consistently able to identify when their thinking is driven by their native egocentrism, and they effectively use a number of strategies to reduce the power of their egocentric thoughts. And remember, I really want to make sure that is emotional self-defense kind of thinking. And I'm using that, I guess, in a little bit of a different way than I've used it before. Emotional self-defense, like intellectual self-defense, could be, a person's emotional fitness, which reduces their susceptibility to emotion or fear-driven arguments or calls to action. Here, we're talking about that anxiety medication that people like to shovel down their mouths when facts are introduced to challenge a safe and comfortable belief system. Relevant intellectual traits at this stage. The key intellectual trait required at this stage is a high degree of intellectual humility in recognizing egocentric and sociocentric thought in one's life, as well as areas of significant ignorance and prejudice. In addition, the thinker at this level needs A, the intellectual insight and perseverance to actually develop new fundamental habits of thought based on deep values to which one has committed oneself. B, the intellectual integrity to recognize areas of inconsistency and contradiction in one's life. C, the intellectual empathy necessary to put oneself in the place of others in order to genuinely understand them. D, the intellectual courage to face and fairly address ideas, beliefs, or viewpoints toward which one has strong negative emotions. E, the fair-mindedness necessary to approach all viewpoints without prejudice, without reference to one's own feelings or vested interests. In the advanced thinker, these traits are emerging, but may not be manifested at the highest level or in the deepest dimensions of thought. Some implications for instruction. For the foreseeable future, most of our students will not become advanced thinkers, if at all, until college or beyond. Nevertheless, it is important that they learn what it would be to become an advanced thinker. It is important that they see it as an important goal. We can help students move in this direction by fostering their awareness of egocentrism and sociocentrism in their thinking by leading discussions on intellectual perseverance, intellectual integrity, intellectual empathy, intellectual courage, and fair-mindedness. If we can graduate students who are practicing thinkers, we will have achieved a major breakthrough in schooling. However intelligent our graduates may be, most of them are largely unreflective as thinkers and are unaware of the disciplined habits of thought they need to develop to grow intellectually. Stage 6, the accomplished thinker. Defining features. Accomplished thinkers not only have systematically taken charge of their thinking, but are also continually monitoring, revising, and rethinking strategies for continual improvement of their thinking. They have deeply internalized the basic skills of thought so that critical thinking is, for them, both conscious and highly intuitive. As Piaget would have put it, they regularly raise their thinking to the level of conscious realization. Through extensive experience and practice in engaging in self-assessment, accomplished thinkers are not only actively analyzing their thinking in all the significant domains of their lives, but are also continually developing new insights into problems at deeper levels of thought. Accomplished thinkers are deeply committed to fair-minded thinking and have a high level of, but not perfect, control over their egocentric nature. Pause right there. So there are some attributes of this level, you know, if you're buying into this whole stage theory thing. And like I said, this is just kind of a framework to give us a better idea of how thinking can develop. You know, like, we're not tied to this model, but if we were going to use it, one of the reasons why I would put myself at 5 instead of 6 is, like, I think there are domains of my life where I could take some of the, you know, the quality of thinking that I do in other areas and move it into those areas as well. And I would have to say, to be completely frank, that at this point, I don't think I'm doing that consistently. And, you know, I hope that as we finish this up, you also think about where you might be on here. The principal challenge at stage 6, to make the highest levels of critical thinking intuitive in every domain of one's life, to internalize highly effective critical thinking in an interdisciplinary and practical way. Knowledge of thinking. Accomplished thinkers are not only actively and successfully engaged in systematically monitoring the role of their thinking of concepts, assumptions, inferences, implications, points of view, etc., but are also regularly improving that practice. Accomplished thinkers have not only a high degree of knowledge of thinking, but a high degree of practical insight as well. Accomplished thinkers intuitively assess their thinking for clarity, accuracy, precision, relevance, logicalness, etc. Accomplished thinkers have deep insights into the systematic internalization of critical thinking into their habits. Accomplished thinkers deeply understand the role that egocentric and sociocentric thinking plays in the lives of human beings, as well as the complex relationship between thoughts, emotions, drives, and behavior. Their skill in thinking. Accomplished thinkers regularly, effectively, and insightfully critique their own use of thinking in their lives and improve it thereby. Accomplished thinkers consistently monitor their own thoughts. They effectively and insightfully articulate the strengths and weaknesses inherent in their own thinking. Their knowledge of the qualities of their thinking is outstanding. Although, as humans, they know they will always be fallible, because they must always battle their egocentrism to some extent. People of good sense seek out master thinkers, for they recognize and value the ability of master thinkers to think through complex issues with judgment and insight. Relevant intellectual traits. Naturally inherent in master thinkers are all the essential intellectual characteristics deeply integrated. Accomplished thinkers have a high degree of intellectual humility, intellectual integrity, intellectual perseverance, intellectual courage, intellectual empathy, intellectual autonomy, intellectual responsibility, and fair-mindedness. Egocentric and sociocentric thought is quite uncommon in the accomplished thinker, especially with respect to matters of importance. There is a high degree of integration of basic values, beliefs, desires, emotions, and action. Some implications for instruction. For the foreseeable future, the vast majority of our students will never become accomplished thinkers. Any more than most high school basketball players will develop the skill or abilities of a professional basketball player, or student writers the writing skills of a published novelist. Nevertheless, it is important that they learn what it would be to become an accomplished thinker. It is important that they see it as a real possibility if practicing skills of thinking becomes a characteristic of how they use their minds day to day. The rest of this article is pretty prescriptive as far as teachers are concerned, so I was going to skip through that and just go right to the closing of the article. There are many ways to teach content so students progress as thinkers. However, if we are to do so, we must explicitly focus on the mind intellectually and grasp the stages that our students must progress through. We and our students must recognize that we all develop incrementally as thinkers, and that the progress of any one of us is directly dependent on our level of intellectual knowledge and commitment. Put it another way, if I am to develop my critical thinking ability, I must both discover my thinking and must intellectually take charge of it. To do this, I must make a deep commitment to this end. So this is one of the things that I really liked, is the perseverance that she mentioned several times in this piece and a couple other pieces that I have read by her, Dr. Elder. Strangely, she follows that very paragraph up with the assertion that I disagree with most. Let me read it to you, and then we can discuss. Why is this so important? Precisely because the human mind, left to its own, pursues that which is immediately easy, that which is comfortable, and that which serves its selfish interests. At the same time, it naturally resists that which is difficult to understand, that which involves complexity, that which requires entering the thinking and predicaments of others. Okay, naturally is an interesting euphemism to describe 15,000 hours of public education, which almost probably every student that she's ever dealt with was subjected to. So that is not natural, and this is something that we've been saying since the very beginning of School Sucks podcast, that if you want to see the way the human mind naturally works, look at a young child who has never had the school system inflicted upon them. And you get a much better sense of the natural curiosity and perseverance of the human mind. Now, I think it's fair to say that we do seek often the path of least resistance in solving some kind of a problem or overcoming a certain obstacle. In some cases, that might be a positive thing, you know, finding an efficient solution or finding a solution in an expeditious manner. And in other cases, it could be a negative thing, trying to find an easier, softer way through a complex problem that needed more time and energy and thought. But because of what we all go through, this perseverance becomes very important because, well, you know, 15,000 hours of anything is somewhat habit forming, I would have to say. So I catch myself being intellectually lazier than I should be all the time, even still. So I really agree with the metacognition and the perseverance, but I in no way agree that this is some kind of natural state of the human mind. Final paragraph. For these reasons, it is crucial that we as teachers and educators discover our own thinking, the thinking we do in the classroom and outside the classroom, the thinking that gets us into trouble and the thinking that enables us to grow. As educators, we must treat thinking, quality thinking, as our highest priority. It is the fundamental determinant of the quality of our lives. It is the fundamental determinant of the quality of the lives of our students. We are at some stage in our development as thinkers. Our students are at some stage in the development of theirs. When we learn together as developing thinkers, when all of us seek to raise our thinking to the next level, and then to the next after that, everyone benefits. And schooling then becomes what it was meant to be, a place to discover the power of lifelong learning. This should be the central goal for all our students, irrespective of their favored mode of intelligence or learning style. It is in all of our interest to accept the challenge, to begin, to practice, to advance as thinkers. The end. Now, some of you might have noticed that I made kind of a poop sound there when she offered her idea of the purpose of schooling. You know, I'll even give her a pass on the use of the word schooling and give you that line one more time. And schooling then becomes what it was meant to be, a place to discover the power of lifelong learning. Well, that sounds like education to me more than schooling. And like we say all the time, schooling and education are pretty opposite. But there's that word that kept poking at us throughout that whole article, egocentrism.
And just to further distinguish this from self-interest, I want to put another definition from outside of this website, just from Wikipedia. Egocentrism is characterized by preoccupation with one's own internal world. Egocentrics regard themselves and their own positions or interests as being the most important or valid. Self-relevant information is seen to be more important in shaping one's judgments than do thoughts about others and other relevant information. Egocentric people are unable to fully understand or cope with other people's opinions and the fact that reality can be different from what they are ready to accept. So there is no reason why, a real collectivist identity can't be part of egocentrism or somebody's worldview that is unshakable by, let's say, facts. And I want to just, like I said, further distinguish egocentrism from self-interest. Because if collectivism is part of somebody's internal world or how they see the world, their mindset, then that is certainly the opposite of self-interest. But this, again, was really dealing with the emotional defenses of people when facts are introduced to discussions or even questions about that worldview are introduced into discussions. So that being said, in lieu of reading the whole other article by Linda Elder, or the paper, Critical Thinking and Emotional Intelligence, which would take us a whole other hour, I've decided that I want to wrap up the show today with some audio. But first, just to explicate a little bit the importance of awareness of emotions in trying to think effectively and rationally, I'm reminded of a couple of quotes. First one is from somebody who was actually on this show before, and I think she was quoting John Taylor Gatto. That was Erica Goldson, the valedictorian who gave that great speech a couple of years ago. And she says, there's a lot of talk about critical thinking, but is there such a thing as uncritical thinking? And I would say, no, that's not thinking. There is a big difference between thinking, rationally responding to something, and reacting. So we want to focus more on response, and I think that requires in all domains of life keeping the emotions in check, because when that thinking becomes emotional, the casualties of that, and we've all, I'm sure, seen this firsthand in others and maybe in some domains of our lives, in ourselves, the casualties of that are identity, causality, and non-contradiction. There's a quote from Ayn Rand that I want to share. Nice segue for us, because we're going to move on to an objectivist writer and lecturer named Diana Shea to close out the show. But I think this quote fits with what we were talking about today. This is from Philosophical Detection. It's in Philosophy, Who Needs It? By Ayn Rand. An emotion as such tells you nothing about reality beyond the fact that something makes you feel something. Without a ruthlessly honest commitment to introspection, the conceptual identification of your inner states, you will not discover what you feel, what arouses that feeling, and whether your feeling is an appropriate response to the facts of reality, or a mistaken response, or a vicious illusion produced by years of self-deception. In the field of introspection, the two guiding questions are, what do I feel, and why do I feel it? So, in closing, we go to Diana Shea, objectivist writer and lecturer, and she has a Q&A webcast called Philosophy in Action that I also recently discovered, and I enjoyed many of her videos. Now, you have to be careful with these hardcore dogmatic objectivists, because one minute you can be nodding your head in agreement and the next minute throwing up in your mouth from what they're saying. Peikoff is a great example of this. I mean, we've talked about the work of Leonard Peikoff from the Ominous Parallels to his course in logic as being somebody who has made some very useful contributions to our scholarship here. You can also go on YouTube and see him telling Bill O'Reilly that the Bush administration is cowardly for not nuking the Middle East into glass. So they're interesting, very hawkish, but on a lot of these philosophical topics, of course, right on the money. So I'll leave you today with this. Thanks for listening to me read. I hope this was useful.
Take care.
Reasoning by facts rather than emotions. How do I know that I'm reasoning based on facts rather than just being driven by my emotions? Often, I feel strong emotions on some personal or political issue. How do I know that I'm not just rationalizing what I want to be true?
Well, I think we've got a preliminary question.
And, so we could probably start with just saying, yeah, we should start with why should somebody be concerned about being driven by emotion?
Yeah, and I'm just going to give a really brief answer to this one. And that is basically, hey, look, you're living in the world. The world is about facts. And if you're gonna be successful, you need to know what the facts are. The world is not shaped by whatever warm and fuzzy emotions you have. Now, emotions are hugely important in life, but they're not knowledge. I think emotions are a person's automatic judgments of value. So, for example, you feel sadness over a loss. You feel anger over an adjustment or an injustice. You feel joy for an achievement. You feel fear when you're threatened, right? And so these are kind of automatic value judgments, but they might be well-founded, but they might not be. You might, a person who let's say was raised by racist parents might fear a black man getting into the elevator with them, but that is not a well-founded judgment. So if you're going to act in a sane way, if you're going to act in a way that's consistent with reality, then you need to judge the facts by reason, not just be rationalizing your emotions.
Right. Yeah. So they're automatized judgments where what you've automatized may or may not be valid. All right. So what are the signs that you're being driven by emotions?
So I don't, there's no sort of overarching theory of this, but I thought I would just give a bunch of sort of quick hits of things that you might notice. So for example, you might have identified, here's the desired conclusion that I want to get to, and you're on the hunt for reasons to justify it, right? So you know what the conclusion is, and now you're going to try to find some reasons to support that. So for example, somebody might say, well, look, society of course has to have a safety net. Now let me figure out what my arguments for that are. No, that's rationalizing. That's not reasoning. It might be that you can't explain. You have a certain conclusion, a kind of gut feeling, but you can't explain your reasons for it in any sensible way. So a man might say, "Well, I know my wife must be cheating. I just know it." But they can't actually give any evidence. Like, well, here, look, she's been making late night phone calls, and she's, you know, we haven't had sex in 6 months, and she's been talking about this coworker all the time, and so on. If you're gonna have that conclusion, you've got to be able to identify what your evidence is for it. Another thing that oftentimes happens is when your argument fails, if you're just offering another argument, that should be a real warning sign. Instead of rethinking what's going on. So, Greg, you had some comments about this, about the arguments for God's existence.
Yeah, that's a standard pattern that many of us have experienced over and over and over. You ask someone, why do you think God exists? And they say, well, here, and they offer the argument from design, and then you show them the issues with the argument from design. And then they say, but what about this? And they offer the argument from miracles, and you show them the issues with the argument from miracles. Yeah, but what about the argument from morality? And they give that one. And you, piece by piece, you go down the list, and it's like, okay, it never occurs to them, like, maybe something's wrong with my thinking here, because I keep offering reasons that have problems, and they're not reasons, and they're not stopping to reconsider what they're saying.
Right.
What should really be going on is that if you notice that kind of error in your thinking, you should be on red alert. You should be looking at that whole issue again. You should be looking at your process and trying to understand, have I rationalized this? Have I gone completely astray? Am I just making stuff up?
Right.
What's gone wrong here?
Right. Yeah. You need to really pause and think about that. Another thing that oftentimes happens is people sort of they'll gloss over things that they know are logical leaps. They'll ignore doubts that they have. So somebody who's saying abortion is murder, and somebody will ask, but doesn't a woman have the right to control her own body? And they can either address that argument, or they can just say, you know, it just doesn't matter. Abortion is murder, right? So, and obviously, I think that there's no real answer to that argument. But there's a difference there in reasoning between somebody who's at least willing to confront challenges versus somebody who's just ignoring them. Another thing, basically, you can refuse to even consider whether you might be wrong, and sometimes people even will get panicked at the thought of of rejecting the views that they hold. And people actually really have this problem sometimes with altruism and egoism. So they think, well, altruism just has to be true. Egoism, you know, that just can't, I don't care what kind of arguments are made for that. It's heartless, it's cruel, it's awful. And they're not even thinking, they're just emoting at that particular point. Oftentimes I think that people, another thing people will do is refuse to think through the logical consequences of their views. And I mentioned this with the Mississippi Personhood webpage about what they say about abortion. And they say that basically, you know, that personhood would prevent women from having this harmful medical procedure. And they're totally ignoring what the actual consequences of an abortion ban would be. And that is absolutely not honest. Another thing is ignoring counterexamples. So people who are religious, they'll say, well, atheists can't possibly be moral, and they're not even going to think about Jane, who they know is you know, a friend of theirs, very moral, and also an atheist. And there's a bunch of other signs here too.
Probably also ignore their own counterexamples.
Yeah. And I do think there's a bunch of other signs too, and the key really here is to just be monitoring your own thinking all the time, to always have, you know, one eye, a little glimpse on what your thinking is doing, so that you can detect these kind of phenomena and say, okay, wait a minute, I've got to go back to the drawing board.
All right, if you notice these signs, what should you do?
Well, I think this was actually the more interesting part of the question for me. Although, actually, I don't know. I liked coming up with this whole list. It was a lot of fun. I think basically, unless it's an emergency, I don't think you should try to immediately force yourself to be rational. Be rational. I think if you have this kind of overwhelming emotion and it's interfering with your reasoning, then focus on that emotion for a minute. Allow yourself to feel that emotion and to feel it really fully. Examine the roots of that emotion. See whether it's justified. And I think once you kind of immerse yourself in that emotion for a few minutes, then it's much easier to step back, to reason calmly and properly, to focus on the facts. But if you're always trying to push the emotion aside, I think the emotion's still going to keep coming in and infecting your reasoning. So I think it's really important to allow yourself to feel the emotion, to understand the emotion, and then allow yourself to set that aside and focus on your reasoning.
Yeah, repression is a bad thing. And every time you talk about introspection, we get the same basic theme. Don't repress. And you do need to always be looking internally. Keep that thread monitoring your own processes. It's like driving. Keep your hands on the wheel. 10 and 2.
Yeah, I like that. You need an intellectual 10 and 2. 10 and 2.
Do you have a take-home point?
Yeah, so I think basically a person can notice the signs of rationalizing feelings rather than reasoning by monitoring his own thinking. And I really think introspection, as always, is the key to noticing and solving this problem.